Yes, and good morning and a big welcome to This Is Your Racing Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And I guess this morning is a man who's had a lifetime in racing, particularly from the veterinary science side of racing for well over 30 years. His name is Glenn Robertson-Smith, and he is a veterinarian that is highly regarded not only here in Australia, but globally as well. He's specialised in the veterinary work, of course, with thoroughbreds, with equines. So let's welcome him in. G'day. How are you, Glenn?
Great, Brian. Thank you for those very kind words.
Good on you. Good to see you. And we've known each other for a fair time, haven't we?
Long time. Used to do some of this on Sports 3Z, I think, in the old
Sport
days.
Sport 927. Yeah, going back. Glenn, wanted to have a chat with you about what's happening in racing at the moment. I think it's pretty safe to say that the sport of racing in this state, and maybe in this country, but particularly in this state at the moment, is in a pretty parlous sort of state in terms of the image of racing and the brand of racing. It's been trashed. It's been trashed principally by disqualifications of some of our biggest names in racing through the cobalt charges over the last 12 months, but particularly in the last 3 months. Is that fair to say?
I think the people involved, the size of the names and the reputation names has put their problems in to the forefront, in the spotlight, and that's put racing into the spotlight too.
The cobalt, it's an essential trace mineral that enables the horse's body to produce vitamin B12, is that correct?
Yep.
Now, can it be actually contained in food, in supplement?
Yes, it is. It's in quite a number of horse supplements. If you like, I can give you a bit of background and try and explain cobalt. I haven't spoken publicly about it before because these cases have been going on and there's been plenty in the media, in the press and online. Some of it's been a bit of misinformation, and I haven't been enamoured with some of the reports coming out of one of the newspapers. I did get involved as an expert witness in the first thoroughbred cobalt case in New South Wales. So to prepare for that case, I was abreast of most of the literature. Since then, more research work or more information has come to hand. I don't want to talk about individuals, but I'd be more than happy to explain some of the historical significance of cobalt and how it's come to light, if you like.
Okay, well, let's look at it. Cobalt is banned in every human sport. Scientists disagree as to whether cobalt is performance-enhancing for horses. What do you say?
Well, historically, cobalt was used in humans in the late 40s and the 50s to treat anemia. Now, we see anemia in people who have kidney problems and they become anemic. Or anemia describes a low red cell count. The kidneys are responsible for producing the blood hormone erythropoietin, or EPO as it's commonly known. EPO is produced by the kidneys, where they have a sensor which senses blood pressure. So if you have a low red cell count or low blood count, the kidney senses that. It produces this hormone EPO, which then travels in the body to the bone marrow, and it stimulates the bone marrow to increase the production and release of red blood cells. So EPO regulates and allows the red cell count to be increased. Now, the red cells contain hemoglobin. Hemoglobin carries oxygen around the body. So if you have more red blood cells, you can carry more oxygen. Oxygen is required for aerobic performance. So we have two forms of athletic performance: anaerobic, which is sprinting. Basically, you can sprint over 100 metres without breathing at all. You're simply using stored energy. Once you start going 400 metres, 800 metres, I'm talking human events now, 400 metres, 800 metres, 1500 marathon, the further you go, the greater requirement for aerobic function, which is a system whereby you breathe in oxygen, carry it in the red blood cells to the cells, and the cells then use that oxygen to manufacture energy. So that's aerobic metabolism. So back to the red blood cells. So EPO can increase the production and release of red blood cells, and that therefore, by its very nature, can improve aerobic function, which is endurance performance. So that's where EPO gets linked to doping allegations, particularly in cycling. We've seen it. And certainly most endurance sports, there have been rumours of EPO being used. There have been, I think, a couple of positives to EPO in racing, but not very much.
Going back a few years, yeah.
Yeah. So the Cobalt Sargus.
So just before you leave the EPO, it wouldn't, if we're talking about horses, it wouldn't probably make a horse go faster, but it would help a horse to go longer. Is that fair enough?
That's a theory, but horses are a bit different from other athletes in that horses have red blood cells stored in the spleen, and when they get excited or stirred up, they release those extra red blood cells. So they have a natural phenomenon. I think it goes back to fright and flight response as an animal. So they can increase their blood count in a fraction of a second just by contracting the spleen. It's a bit different from other species. And there are some people who believe that that capacity means that drugs like EPO may not have such a profound effect in horses as they might in other animals.
Right. Back to cobalt.
So in the late 40s, early 50s, in human medicine, it was used for people with kidney failure. So that their kidneys were failing. They were in renal failure. They weren't producing levels of EPO. And then someone worked out that cobalt seemed to manage these patients and enable them to increase their red cell count. It's subsequently been discovered that at the cell level there is a gene expression, a little trigger called an hypoxic inducible factor, which is a sensor in the cell, and it tells the cell whether there's enough, excess or deficiency of oxygen. Now, cobalt seems to act on that gene expression as a stabilizer, so it locks on and prolongs the effect of this HIF sensor. So in a way, it tricks the cell to believing that there's not enough oxygen, and that message is sent throughout the body, and that means that increase goes to the kidneys, and the kidneys respond by saying there's not enough oxygen, we will produce more erythropoietin, and that then results in an increased red cell count. So that's the background of where cobalt fits into doping thoughts. And I believe that out of the US it was discovered quite a few years ago that in standardbreds in the US that some people were using cobalt, and there's a private racetrack at the Meadowlands, and the owner of that track had some horses tested for cobalt, and they showed high levels. And then the international racing regulatory community got together and decided that there was enough intelligence that cobalt was being abused, and they set about trying to regulate the use of it.
How much cobalt can a horse actually produce itself?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
All individuals?
We know that it's deficiency of cobalt in ruminant animals such as cattle and sheep can cause cobalt deficiency disease called Coast disease. And interestingly, horses grazing the same cobalt deficient pastures don't seem to get affected. So as far as I'm aware, there aren't any reports of cobalt deficiency in horses. So horses seem to be able to get enough. They don't need very much cobalt, and they seem to be able to get enough from a normal diet.
Right. Our threshold is 200 microgram threshold, which is double the international threshold. Why would that be so?
Again, I don't know, because I'm not a regulatory vet.
But why would Hong Kong, say, have a threshold of 100, yet, you know, it's such a virtually a neighbouring racing jurisdiction to Australia, and why would we have 200? That to me is saying that we're being quite lenient with the threshold.
I think it's been described as generous. Hong Kong's a little bit different in that it's a closed environment whereby the regulatory body control all of the veterinary aspects, and everything is basically in a lockdown environment, so they can control what supplements the horses get, when they get them, how close to racing. So they probably have an opportunity to more tightly regulate what happens to the horses, and that would enable them to then enforce a lower threshold. There have been a number of population studies that show that the level in a resting horse or a normal horse is somewhere less than 10. So in the population studies, I believe Australia wasn't included, nor was the US, because there was concern that our population may have been biased because of cobalt use occurring in our populations. But there was something like 12,000 horses assessed from a number of countries all around the world, and the range was, I believe, 0.1 to about 70, and the average was around 5. So it's not something that horses need in great amounts. And because there's concern over potential abuse from a doping viewpoint, there was, I think, a need to introduce a threshold. The threshold's been set probably based on what happened in New South Wales. New South Wales Harness were the first jurisdiction to establish a threshold in this country, and that was then followed by Racing Victoria, and then the ARB made it a national rule, I think, in January of last year.
Two veterinary surgeons, Adam Matthews in New South Wales, has been outed for 5.5 years. Tom Brennan in New South Wales and Victoria, 6 years and 5 years. It's a scourge on your profession. Your vets, you as a vet, you're registered as a vet.
We're licensed by and regulated by the veterinary board,
okay,
who in each state...
But you're not licensed by the racing body.
No, and in the past I had been against such a move and wasn't a supporter, but given that the profession has been damned by some of these cobalt scenarios and even some of the ibuprofen things, I think I'd be quite happy to see registration occur for vets. The argument against it is we don't need to be policed by... two groups, by the veterinary board or by the racing board. But I'd have to say, I think to date, the veterinary board have been somewhat inactive in terms of intervening and supervising and regulating vets. And I think that's why the industry are looking to maybe license veterinarians. So if you're going to work in a racing industry, you're licensed along with everyone else. At the moment, it's said that we're the only unlicensed and, by default, the only unregulated group. So I don't
see a shift. Yeah,
yeah. I don't see a problem with becoming licensed. Effectively, we are, insofar as I think there's been a rule change from Sal Perno's office that vets now are obliged to attend inquiries. And we, part of our charter from the veterinary board is we agree to abide by the rules of racing. So by default, we're regulated. But I don't see a problem with being licensed. It's happened in New South Wales. Philandes has brought through a rule where vets are licensed in New South Wales. And I don't really see a problem with it. If you're going to abide by the rules and do what you're meant to do, you shouldn't have any concerns with being licensed.
It's extraordinary when you think that a country of our size, where vets have to be licensed under the jurisdiction of New South Wales racing, yet in Victoria it still hasn't happened. Divided by the Murray River. How can that be? We can't get even races to go on time, etc.
That's a quirky feature of Australia, isn't it? That the states want autonomy in most things. So there's no national registration of vets, and therefore we deal with our state regulatory body. But to date, they've been fairly quiet about the profession's involvement in cobalt and the like, and perhaps the racing industry, sees the opportunity to implement some regulation.
The two vets who've been disqualified, they've been disqualified from racing, yet they can still practice day to day, can't they?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's the difference. But in New South Wales, would that they'd be banned from racing? But again, day to day, can they still practice?
Yes, as I understand it.
So the veterinary board in New South Wales or in Victoria wouldn't have taken any action against these people?
I'm not aware of any that's happened to date, but one would expect that they would have to front the veterinary board and there'd be an investigation, but I wouldn't preempt that. But I would expect that's the role of the veterinary board to ensure that the profession behave appropriately and do things within the regulations which we're given. And they're quite strong regulations. We have to, there are certain rules with prescribing drugs. The animals need to be under your care. You need to prescribe On the basis of a proper clinical evaluation examination, you need to determine that a therapeutic need exists, and then you need to prescribe medicines which are restricted for use by us in an appropriate way, meaning amounts and dose and duration and that like.
We'll take a break. We're speaking with Dr. Glenn Robertson-Smith, one of our most renowned veterinary surgeons here in Australia, a man who's spent a lifetime in the profession. We're going for a break. Then when we come back, I'd like to talk to you, Glenn, about how do we keep, as an owner, how do we keep these horses on the track? And that's a pretty important question to ask, I'm sure.
Great.
Okay, this break, then back with more with Glenn Robertson-Smith. My guest this morning is Dr. Glenn Robertson-Smith, who's been in the business of looking after thoroughbreds in the equine veterinary world for well over 30 years. Just before we talk about keeping horses on the racetrack, horses' welfare, what about the damage to the animal itself, say with something like cobalt?
Well, I think it's a good reason why we need rules in place for things like cobalt. The Americans have introduced thresholds, and they are saying from their research work that it's introduced almost exclusively as a welfare aspect, irrespective of whether it enhances performance or not. Their studies have shown that horses getting high doses of cobalt react badly. They're injured by it. They sweat profusely. They tremble. Some of them collapse. So there's a concern from a welfare viewpoint where drugs are being abused. I mentioned historically earlier that cobalt was used in the 40s and 50s to improve blood counts in people. It was abandoned because it was found it caused a significant number of toxic problems in people with heart failure, thyroid problems, nerve problems. In recent times, cobalt's been part of some metal-on-metal hip implants, and there are some class actions around the world related to those implants chronically leaching cobalt into the body and optic and auditory nerve damage. So cobalt's not very nice. It's a heavy metal poison, and if there's no therapeutic need for it in the horse, it shouldn't be given, and it certainly shouldn't be given in massive doses. And the anecdotal evidence is to get a blood-boosting effect and the performance effect, you need to give high doses for long periods. So it's bad news. We shouldn't be using it, and as vets, we need to be very conscious of the welfare of the horse. We've got you mentioned the veterinary board and the role of vets. We're in a very privileged position as horse vets. We've got to look after these horses. We've got to help the trainers train them. We've got to help them remain healthy and well. But we're the link between the horse and their care, and we need to ensure that we do what is absolutely best for the animal in terms of providing good veterinary care, good health, and the best thing. We're looking after that animal, and it's a very privileged role, and it's a unique role.
Glenn, just moving away from cobalt, the other big issue at the moment in racing is ibuprofen. That can stay in the system. That's causing a hell of a headache for a top horse in a horse called Sign Off with Darren Weir, and other horses where they're testing one day, they're testing all clear, the next day they're testing positive, the next time around it'll be all clear. They told us recently that it's similar to a sort of like a Nurofen. Is that correct?
Yeah, ibuprofen. If you go and look at some Nurofen gel or Nurofen tablets, you'll see the active ingredient is ibuprofen. Ibuprofen is in a class of drugs called a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, similar to phenylbutazone or aspirin. There's a whole list of them. In a similar way to cobalt, one of the issues we've got is use of a non-registered product. Now, it might be brilliant for tendon treatments, and I've certainly used it, and I think it was looking like it was very encouraging. But the trouble with using compounded drugs and drugs which are not registered is that we don't know enough about them. So if you and I want to get together and we want to market a drug for use in horses, we need to get it registered and licensed. And we go to the APVMA, which is the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medical Association, and they will require us to do exhaustive tests on the drug in terms of what it does, and that's what it does therapeutically, what it does from a toxicologic viewpoint, how it's absorbed into the body, how it's eliminated, and there is a wealth of information that goes along paralleling with those trials. So in the absence of registration, we don't quite know what goes on, and that's what's happened with ibuprofen, in that it looked like it was going to be a ray of light for treating tendon injuries, and you're familiar with tendon injuries.
Sure.
It was a
yeah.
was a death sentence for a horse. You know, if you got a tendon, that was the end of the horse. And it looked like it was going to totally reverse that and give horses the chance of coming back and being racehorses again. And I was involved with some of the original studies that were done. They were done at Cranbourne with Michael Kent's stable. They're very, very exciting and encouraging. Instead of the horse having a 12-month spell, a very short 6 to 8 week spell, some rehab, and then back into work. But ibuprofen is a unique drug insofar as, not totally unique, but it goes into the body as ibuprofen. It doesn't get metabolized or altered by the kidney or the liver and other structures, and it gets excreted as ibuprofen. So that means there's no ability to time frame when the drug was given, how long it's been there. And what I understand, what I'm led to believe, because I've spoken to Brian Stewart at Racing Victoria because of the concern over ibuprofen, we don't really know, but we think it's getting absorbed into body tissue like fat, might well be fat. And then when the horses go out and exercise at a fairly intense level, fat is metabolized, fat's burnt, and ibuprofen, which has been bound into the fat, is then re-released, and notwithstanding it might have been there for 3 months or 2 months or a month, it's re-released and at reasonably high levels. So we've got an anti-inflammatory drug being detected in the urine, which might mean it was given 2 days ago, might mean it's been there for 6 months. So it's a dilemma for owners, trainers of those horses, and also for racing regulators, because in Australia, rightly, we've adopted drug-free racing, which I think is the way to go. And that drug-free racing means that you need to present your horse to the races drug-free. It doesn't mean you can't treat it. If you treat it, you need to be aware of the excretion time. So if we use phenylbutazone, we don't use that within 7 days of racing. If we use hydrocortisone, we don't use that within 48 hours of a race. So there are anti-inflammatory drugs we can use, but as veterinarians, we need to be very familiar with the elimination of that drug from the horse so that we can advise our clients that when you take that horse to the races, it's drug-free.
Yeah.
The problem with ibuprofen would seem that it gets bound into body tissues, and then once it's bound in tissue like fat, its excretion is totally unpredictable, and no one knows, and that's the problem. So those horses can race, but they might well test positive again. And if you've got a positive in a horse with an anti-inflammatory drug at a level which indicates it's having an effect, positive.
That's exactly right, because the ruling which Racing Victoria had to bring down, which was about a week ago, had to be that way, didn't it? We are drug-free racing. So if you have a horse that goes to the races through these extenuating circumstances you talk about, the drug that's being used to help with tendon problems, if it returns a positive, that's it. You've got to lose the race, and maybe your trainer's got to be dealt with. So
I'm sure
that's a difficult part now.
Yeah, it is, and I'm sure they looked at trying to find these things called isomers. The drugs get a mirror image of themselves, and they're called isomers. I think they're looking to see if they could differentiate what's new and what's old. I know they're looking at threshold levels. I mean, that would have been a nice simple answer, that the amount being released is small and it's below the threshold. But it seems to be unpredictable, and it's a problem. And I don't think there's a quick fix, but it goes back to using a drug about which we don't know enough in terms of how it's bound within the body and how it's eliminated, because it's not registered. Without registration, you then don't know how long you can use the drug for what period, or necessarily what dose rate. So with all drugs, there is a risk of toxicology if you use drugs for a prolonged period or in high doses. Everything has an element of toxicity to it. So that's why we need registered drugs, and that's why we need veterinarians who are advising people on that information. This is how long you can use it for, and this is how you need to treat it. So when we put horses on some of these cortisone products, there is a high dose and a reducing dose over a finite period. Phenylbutazone, very common anti-inflammatory, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug in horses, at high levels is incredibly toxic. And it'll kill the horse. So when we use products, we need to be aware of the risks of those products, and the risks involve dose, duration, all those types of things.
The hidden facts in racing also are, after a day of racing, say at Flemington on Saturday or Caulfield last Saturday, what about Sunday morning when the trainer's got to go and see, first of all, did the horse leave any feed in the bin? But then they check their joints, they check their action to see whether they might have pulled up a little short in their action, was the track too firm? What sort of attrition rate, have you noticed any variance on it really? Is it higher now in the world we live in now? Are the tracks firmer because the preparation of tracks has changed over the last few years? What do you see as a veterinary surgeon?
I think it's more seasonal, and I'd say over my long journey in this sport, it hasn't changed terribly much. It's a seasonal problem, and the seasons relate to the age of the horses competing. So this time of the year, heading to the two-year-old races at the end of summer where the tracks are pretty hard, we do see a lot of horses with bone and joint problems. But I wouldn't say that we're seeing more horses sustaining significant injuries this year or last year than what we saw 10 years ago. So I think it's more of a seasonal problem related to Australians' climatic conditions and the age of the horses. And we seem to believe that there's an attrition rate of horses of about 40 to 50% per year. So if you take all the two-year-olds, half of them race as three-year-olds and half again, that might well reflect horses that are structurally more have better integrity of their bones and heart and lung system. So there's a selection process that the better horses perform better for longer. You know, they're able to endure the rigours of training and racing. When you introduced me at the start and you said, I've been doing this for a long time, 30 years, I was thinking on the way in, what are the best horses I've treated? And ironically, the really good horses you don't have too much to do with, because they're better horses. They've got better joints, better legs. They have less problems from a veterinary viewpoint. So the really champion racehorses, sadly, you don't have as much to do with as the other horses.
But you had a bit to do with Maccabi Diva. A
little bit to do with Maccabi Diva, and had some pretty good standard breeds along the way.
Golden Rain
for Noel Alexander and Shane Davies. When I was early in my career, I was an intern doing surgery at Werribee with Alistair McLean, a great colleague and friend of mine, and we operated on Popular Arm when he split a Paston.
So those pins all inserted.
I got introduced to some superstars very early on, and I've been very fortunate throughout my career to work with some legendary vets, and I was able to do the Freeman brothers' work for a period of 10 years, and that was exceptional. You know, good horses, and they were delightful to work for.
Yeah. You created the Melbourne Veterinary Clinic at Caulfield. Was it for about 20 years you and partners set it up?
I started it on my own in about 1990. And again, when I'd come back from America and taught surgery at Werribee, and then I went into practice and started on my own, and then had a couple of young vets work for me, and was doing work for Freedman's at that time, and John Sadler, Colin Alderson, and Noel and Jane. So I had quite good support from clients, and the practice grew reasonably quickly. And just to give it a brand, I called it Melbourne Equine Veterinary Group. And I think Lee Freedman helped me establish a hospital at Caulfield, because they had that very big base at Caulfield. And we set up quite a big practice that ended up having about 10 vets in it, and an operating theatre, because my background was in the States. I trained in surgery, so I was had some background in surgery.
Gee, there would have been horses like Scalacci and Paris Lane, and champions come through that stable.
Oh, it was unbelievable. Yeah. Great times.
Now, you must have had a passion for first of all, the horses too. How does a young bloke decide that he wants to be an equine veterinary surgeon?
probably the wrong answer. I have an agricultural science degree, and I cut my leg, and I was on crutches for a long time, and I was out at the agricultural field station at Mount Derrimut, and I was finishing up. I was going to be an ag scientist, and then this dude drove in a BMW, and I said, "Who's he?" to some of the other students. I said, "Oh, he's the vet." And I thought, "I think I'd rather be one of them." and then I went down to Werribee. So I didn't grow up with horses. I grew up in suburbia. I used to do a lot of rowing anyway. So ended up at the vet school at Werribee, and we're doing, you know, all creatures great and small. And again, I went down to the equine hospital, and that was probably the only main equine hospital in Victoria at the time. And Vic Spears was there, who was a legendary surgeon, and Alistair McLean, and George Hanlon's horse Lawman was there. And now deceased, a great friend of mine, John Van Veenendaal, was there as well. So as a final year student, I went down to this horse area where, again, there are a bunch of dudes and champion horses, and I thought I'll try and be one of those. And I was lucky enough to get there was an internship for 2 years after I graduated. So I graduated in 81, and then I took a two-year internship in surgery with a master's degree. And during that time, there was a renowned Australian surgeon in America called Simon Turner, and he was he'd been to Melbourne Grammar here, and he knew about rowing. So I went to one of his courses, and he remembered I'd rowed at school, and I'd won the head of the river, and he said, "Oh, you should come to the States." So after I finished at Werribee, I then jumped on a plane and went to a place called Purdue University in Indiana, and I trained there for nearly 4 years in surgery and stuff. And Purdue's quite a renowned university, not for vets, but they produce astronauts, and Neil Armstrong trained at Purdue. So So I had 4 years in Indiana, which was marvellous. And I came back to Werribee and taught surgery, and then fortunately went into practice around 1990 and got Freedies on board and a few others. It was good.
Taking a break now, this is Dr. Glenn Robertson-Smith, and we're talking about veterinary science, and we'll be back in just a moment. This is Your Racing Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Back with Dr. Glenn Robertson-Smith, and we're talking about veterinary science, equine veterinary science. Glenn, it's not only racehorses and, you know, supposed doping. It just seems to be, is there a culture change here that we're noticing in our country or across the world with every sport, every competitive sport?
Look, you mentioned at the outset that it seems bad for racing at the moment. I don't necessarily agree that it's bad for racing. Certainly racing's in the spotlight, but mainly because of the identity of the people who've become embroiled in the positive swabs. I think if we'd had a two-horse trainer from the back of the bush, it wouldn't have been such a big issue. But because of the names of those involved and the size of their businesses and the number of horses involved, it's become big news.
But you know, if they, sorry to interrupt, but if, you know, a couple of these are going to VCAT, so we can't comment. But if the charges are sustained, it's virtually career-ending. 3 to 5 years can effectively, it'll close the stable down.
Yeah.
And people lose jobs. Yeah. Horses have to be moved.
Massive.
How does a trainer come back from that? Anyway, that's a separate issue, but let's talk about what you just mentioned about sport.
Well, I think drugs are permeating sport everywhere you look, and that's why it's a challenge for regulators to keep ahead of the game and ensure that we do have a level playing field. So there's an interesting story about a group in San Francisco called BALCO, which stands for Bay Area Laboratory Cooperative. And they're around in the 80s and 90s. And basically, it was a lab doing designer drugs for athletes to enhance performance. And the concept was that we'll make these things up and they won't be detectable. And you know, the mentality might have been that if they can't find it, I'm not cheating, which is not true. Just because the analyst can't find something, it doesn't mean that you're not cheating if you're using it. And then what subsequently happened is there were congressional and Senate inquiries in the US, and they got involved, and that whole company was put out of, I think some of them went to jail, and it was a downfall of one of America's Olympic superstars, Marion Jones. She was apparently taking anabolic steroids. So it's a mentality that permeates lots of sport, not just racing. you know, if I can use something which can't be found, then that's okay. And it's not. I think the mentality needs to shift to what am I able to do within the rules, and how do I comply with the rules and still be successful at my chosen sport. I don't want to talk about football too much, but in essence, people get into what they call peptides because there's a difficulty with detecting peptides. So,
what does peptide do? What will it do for an athlete, a footballer?
Okay, it's a good question, and it's a term which people bant around, which is not well explained. A protein is a long molecule. So, for a visual example, say it's a foot long, and there might be a little section in the middle of that of a couple of peptides which are joined together, and that's the active ingredient. So, in an anabolic steroid, you might have a little section which causes your hair to grow, another section which causes you to grow muscle. So the scientists now can split these molecules and select an area which targets a specific function. So that's what peptides are. They're a fraction of a protein molecule, and they have a very precise and specific effect. But they're hard to pick up. They're hard to detect. So it gives people who want to, in essence, cheat with drugs an opportunity to do that, believing they won't be caught.
But will we see a cultural shift, as you're implying? But are we ever going to see that? Because it's become such a world of competitive sport at win at all costs.
That's it. And
so I'll take the risk. I'll take the risk and maybe roll the dice and hope not to be detected.
Well, you see that in human sports. The rewards in terms of reputation and financial rewards for being the best in the world means that for some people it's worth rolling the dice. And in racing, the two things collide, gambling and athletic performance. So there's a greater opportunity for corruption to come into our sport, which means the regulators should be applauded for having a tough line, and there've got to be consequences for people in my profession. If we make mistakes, we're dealt with, and clearly that's why New South Wales have registered vets, because they didn't believe that the consequences coming from the veterinary board were significant. I mean, it's not good enough that I can treat your horse, get banned by racing, and I can go down the road and run a small animal practice. I think there are no consequences for that. So,
and I'm the one that suffers.
Yeah.
I lose the race. I lose the prize money. My trainer can be outed for 12 months and you walk off and go back to looking after canaries.
I mean, there'd be plenty of people who won't like my opinions, but I'm entitled to have them. And I think consequences are good. Consequences mean that if people want to roll the dice, they're weighing up. And if the risks mean you might lose your livelihood for a period of time as a vet or a horse trainer, then you might think twice about doing it.
Well, you've got to be responsible for your actions, don't you?
Particularly. And where, as vets, where we're responsible for the well-being of the animal, even more so.
And Glenn, when you look at sort of what's happening now, but just over the last 3, 4, 5, even last 10 years, is there a difference in, you know, what results we're getting in terms of positive swabs compared to, say, a decade ago? Are we following a trail? Is there a trail to what's maybe happening in the US, or is it a trail that in other parts of the world that we're following? Do you see any trend there?
I think we're getting less positives.
Are we?
Yeah, yeah. I don't think there are nearly as many positives. The positives used to be traces of therapeutic drugs, which meant that, again, going back to what I mentioned, ibuprofen, that maybe we didn't understand how the drug was withheld in the body and then metabolised and then excreted. But I think there are less positives than there used to be. And there's been quite a shift in the rules too. And again, some of the rule changes have met with a fair bit of resistance from the industry. And I haven't agreed with all the rule changes, but then the rules now make it very hard to interfere with your horse. You cannot drench your horse within 24 hours of race day, a rule which is brought in to prevent people tubing them with bicarb or so-called milkshaking. So that was a reactionary rule. We have a rule whereby now you can't inject a horse within 24 hours of race day. You can't do hardly anything on race day. Again, I would see those as reactionary rules to make it harder for people to be mischievous.
We're dealing with animals that weigh on average 5 to 550 kilograms. So the care for these animals, particularly up until, you know, to when they do go out and have their race start, but also the post race, and we spoke about what happens on Sunday after the Saturday's races. So you know, if we're racing every day virtually about 2 days of the year, it's constant for horses to then seek attention the next day. How difficult, and I come back to this question, how difficult is it to keep these horses at the racetrack? Because we as owners, we don't want them in the paddock. We want them, you know, if we've paid a lot of money for them, we're paying high fees for training, we want them at the races. So, you know, do you find that your hands are tied by more restriction coming down from authorities as to what you can do to help horses?
No, I don't. I think if you need to treat them that close to the race, they probably shouldn't be racing. Again, some of the listeners might not like to hear that, but I also think if you need to treat them close to race and they've got a problem, they're probably not going to be very competitive anyway. So if I see a horse with a mild lameness, I'm always advocating not to race the horse, to treat it, manage it properly, and maybe race it in a couple of weeks, give the horse an opportunity to recover. So I don't see any of these new regulations as significantly impacting on what we do. There was a change to the intra-articular cortisone rule, whereby we used to treat horses within maybe 6 or 7 days of a race. That was based on the withholding of the drug, and that was changed that it's a 10-day period now. I don't think it made any difference at all, because there are, if you need to go closer, there are other things you can put into the joint which have some effect, just not cortisone. And it means that if we're going to use cortisone, we're using it a little bit further away from the race, which is probably a good thing. So, again, you could argue if you need to put cortisone into a joint 2 days before a race, should that horse be racing? The one rule I probably struggled with a little bit, and I suspect it was introduced on the basis of international harmony, having a rule where we fit it in with the rest of the world, or particularly with Europe, and that was the outright banning of anabolic steroids. And again, that almost sounds like a contradiction. Here am I advocating anabolic steroid use, but I'm, on the other hand, espousing the virtues of drug-free racing. I think anabolics, particularly with our horse population on our hard tracks, hard ground, and a population which is composed of a lot of geldings, anabolics had a very good therapeutic role to enable those horses to recover from some of these injuries and spell well and come back robust and recovered. And I think we're missing some of that treatment management with the loss of anabolics.
Another big issue and a hot issue in racing is the use of the whip by jockeys. Do you have a view on that?
I do. But probably not the response you're expecting. One of the big changes I've seen in racing, which relates to these rule changes, is an acknowledgement and respect for animal welfare. And we can include cobalt in that. We can include the whip. We can include anabolic steroids, cortisones. I have seen the animal activists become a much more vocal minority and a much more influential minority. And I think there are plenty of activists out there who would love to see the back end of racing, and they'd be relishing the current problems we have. So Brian Stewart, who's a colleague of mine, I have great respect for him. His title is not head veterinarian at Racing Victoria. He's head of animal welfare and veterinary regulation. So the industry themselves have recognised the need to have a welfare aspect and component in a very significant way. And as an industry, we need to make sure we have welfare to the fore with all of our rules, with all of our structures, because if we don't, we'll give the animal welfare lobby an opportunity to do more damage. I got involved with a case with a horse that broke its leg at the races, and the barrier attendant did a remarkable job. It was at Warrnambool, and the horses were doing two circuits of the racetrack. And I believed he put himself at risk, and he did a remarkable job to move that horse away from the circling field. yet unbelievably, the RSPCA prosecuted him for aggravated animal cruelty. And they had a veterinarian from Sydney who gave a witness statement that the horse should not have been moved and what he did was cruel. And the RSPCA actively pursued him, which I thought was improper. If they wanted to pursue something, they could have challenged Racing Victoria. And in the end, just before it went to court, two of my colleagues and myself, we gave witness statements that we thought what he did was entirely appropriate and didn't, was not an aspect of animal cruelty, and the RSPCA dropped the case. But it highlights that we need to be very cognizant and aware of everything with welfare. And I go back to what I said, as a veterinarian, we have a unique role and a very privileged role to provide the support for the animals.
Have you scaled down your operation now?
Yeah, look, I went through a little speed hump with the practice. It became quite a big practice, and I wanted to go in different directions from the other partners. So I got bought out of the practice, but was able. We agreed that I was able to keep going because I love being a vet. I don't know what I do. I don't play golf or do anything else. So I went. I've got a farm in Muradak and set up a smaller practice in Cranbourne and Mornington, and doing race horses primarily. But we do some pretty good dressage horses, and back doing some standard breeds.
Do you have partners?
No.
On your own?
Oh, I've got Ray Hutchinson, Ron's son. Ray.
No, I didn't mean partner. I meant partners in your business, yeah.
Yeah, Hutchie, and I've got two other vets, Sean Madigan, an Irish lad who's going back to Ireland, and Michelle Papps just joined. So there's three or four of us.
So where do you, just in conclusion here, where do you see the sport heading in terms of what we're going through at the moment? As I say, it's a bit of a parlous state. We're going through tough times. Racing's terribly resilient, though. It does survive. It always has.
Yeah, I don't think the problem is as big as it seems. As I say, I think it's because of the profile of the people involved that it's become big news. But I think there's an opportunity to have a culture change, and the rules are contributing to that. You need to play within the rules, and I think racing will survive. There are always young trainers coming up, young vets coming up, young owners coming up. So it'll survive.
Is there still a lot of interest in your profession, you know, you see from the younger ranks?
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, there is. I mean, it's a fantastic job. I mean, I've had such a privileged life, and I get up and go to work reasonably early and look forward to every day.
Great to have a chat with you, Glenn. Good luck for the rest of your career and the journey that you continue on with. I know you're... As I said at the start of the program, you're highly acclaimed. You are terribly well respected right across the board. So it's nice to know that people, do think a fair bit of you.
Thank you very much for your kind words.
Good on you. Thank you. Glenn Robertson-Smith, my special guest on This Is Your Racing Life, a different racing life, a veterinary surgeon on 1116 SEN.